This is London calling North America. Next in our program, we present London Letter by MacDonald Hastings. Stand by now for MacDonald Hastings. This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Calling. This week, MacDonald Hastings talks about the Anglo-American loan and tells you some of the most important ways in which it will be used.
This is MacDonald Hastings with grateful acknowledgements for $3,750 million from London. And the wonder is, after the dogfight as to whether the loan was going through or not, that we're still on speaking terms at all. Perhaps it proves that democracy works after all, that the Anglo-American way of discussing our affairs in open forum is a good way. Because although we seem to have called each other all the names under the stars these past 9 months, at the end of it all, you've chosen decisively to cast in your lot with ours. If the Anglo-American loan had been repudiated by the House of Representatives, I think it's not too much to say that the whole basis of American foreign policy, all our hopes of making a better world together, would have collapsed. We should have been faced with a situation, and I should be interested to know if experts in American affairs like Mr. Walter Lippmann share the same view. We should have been faced with a situation far more serious in historical consequence than when Congress defied Wilson's administration in 1919 and stood out of the League of Nations. The money, important as it is for the hopes of world economic recovery, the money is one of the lesser considerations of the decision to implement the loan agreement. What really matters is that from now on, Britain and America are to seek world peace, prosperity, not in competition, but side by side. And every thinking person must realize that only by this kind of integration of our affairs can any of us look forward to anything but economic and ultimately global disaster. Maybe you think that's the voice of perfidious Albion talking again. The wily Englishman rubbing his hands because he's outsmarted Uncle Sam once more. You wouldn't think so if you could overhear some of the dinner table conversation in London. I heard somebody drop one of the biggest bricks of a lifetime only a few days ago. It was one of the men's clubs here where they have the pleasant custom of having a communal dining table. Everybody who comes in to dinner, whether he's acquainted with the other men or not, sits down at the same table and joins in the conversation. On this occasion, a man came in, threw down his evening paper, and addressing the table in general, said, "I'm sick to death of hearing about these Americans and their something loan. If I had my way, I'd tell them to take it," and so he went on. When he'd finished his speech, one of the other diners at the table leaned across and said, "I'm most interested in what you say, sir. But as one of the American senators now on a visit to London, I'd like to add a few remarks on behalf of my own country." What the senator said, by the way, we were all too embarrassed to ask him who he was. What the senator says doesn't... The point is that as soon as he revealed himself, the man who'd spoken felt thoroughly ashamed and could only mumble apologies. Anyhow, he didn't mean what he said. He was simply shooting his mouth to ease his feelings, and he did it because he was absolutely certain that nobody was there to catch him up. A million to one chance turned against him, and I imagine he hasn't stopped kicking himself for a fool ever since. The moral of that story is that there are thousands of people in London, as I guess there are thousands on your side, allowing their half-baked emotions to lead their heads. It isn't pleasant for England or Englishmen to feel that we've had to go to America for financial help. I can imagine that it isn't particularly pleasant for you to have to bolster England up with American dollars. But the reason that England has got into a position where she's had to ask your assistance is a reason which no Englishman need feel ashamed of. And the reasons that have prompted you to help us, well, they go deeper than questions of collateral. And most of the silly, unfortunate and outrageous pieces of nonsense that have gained currency on both sides of the Atlantic these past 9 months, most of them would never have been voiced in the first place if an American had been there when an Englishman talked out of turn, or vice versa. There's no better check to loose talking than the presence of somebody who may catch you out. In the debate over the loan, a lot has been said that was quite unjustified by the facts. But relatively, I believe it's been as insignificant as the thoughtless remarks of the idiot at the London dinner table. It hasn't meant anything. And the proof is that after every insult has been thrown backwards and forwards over the Atlantic, you've made one of the great and generous decisions of history. We haven't outsmarted you this time. We've put all our bomb-battered cards face up. You've called us a lot of something, Zimies, and thrown us your roll of notes to go on with. And now, you want to know what we're going to do with the money. It seems amazing that as we count up $3,750 million, we have to say, as Lord Keynes, the great British economist, had to say, you're cutting it pretty fine. But that's the fact. The loan is at best the bare minimum we need for economic recovery. There's no margin for a celebration. We're having to distribute the dollars as parsimoniously as a widow's pension. The immediate consequence of the American credit is the negative one, that it will protect us from an even more testing period of austerity than we've been through already. We can now think about climbing up instead of how far more we've got to climb down. The money will be used, first of all, to buy capital in the form of tools and machinery to enable us to make the goods to pay the money back. Next, there'll be an allocation for food, if possible, to get us a more varied diet in the winter. The purpose of that is because it's as important we should invest in the well-being of the workers who make the goods that England needs to sell as it's important to have the machinery. Next, we shall buy raw materials and a certain quantity of necessary consumer goods, such as newsprint, which at the moment is in undemocratically short supply in Britain. For the rest, the money will be used to correct sterling balances, facilitate money exchange, and other complicated matters which I expect are as bewildering to you as they are to me. We won't do everything at once. The experts say that only a quarter of the loan will be released in the first year. But if the plan works out as it's hoped it will, the loan will drip like a can of oil on the wheels of world trade. Will Britain be able to pay it back? That depends a great deal on the general prosperity of the world. To make the scheme work, it's essential that there should be a great increase in world trade, which, after all, is what we all want. British goods must flow into America as American goods flow into Britain. High tariffs must come down. And we must all learn to think not continentally, but globally. In brief, if Britain is not in a position to pay when the time comes, the outlook for the world in general is likely to be pretty unpromising. And the loan will be one of the least of our troubles. If Britain is in a position to pay, it'll mean that we've come quite a long way in the program for a better world we're all talking about. So England's main preoccupation, now that the loan is through, is to use it to the uttermost for the invigoration of our national life, the national trade, and ultimately world trade. But the responsibility for the future is still yours as well as ours. The loan is the first token of continuing Anglo-American operation. The next step is yours again. To create the conditions to allow the debtor nations, such as Britain, to import goods into America to help pay for the goods we're buying with your dollars now. Because it's clear that no world economy can work unless goods flow both ways. From the viewpoint of the individual, what that means is that we must increase our consumption of the world's good things. To use up the world's immense capacity for production to keep trade going, we must all become bigger buyers and lead better, fuller lives with even more gadgets to play with than we've got now. There are, in fact, only two alternatives. Either overproduction, unemployment, slump, or an increasing demand for the world's goods in ever greater variety and, in consequence, full employment and world prosperity. The passing of the loan is a first step, a faltering one, perhaps, but still the first step towards achieving the sort of world we all want. If the same spirit of cooperation survives in the next 5 or 10 testing years, if the principle of working it out together continues to animate Anglo-American relations, the opponents of the loan will have to eat their words yet. Still, the world is far too uncomfortable to pin too much hope on utopia yet a while. The first thing is to clear up the mess we're in at the moment. And in the immediate future, I don't doubt that the opponents of the loan will have plenty of opportunity to discover justification for their arguments. Oh, yes, we shall have plenty more rows in Congress and Parliament, too. But if all the arguments turn out as well as the arguments in these past few months, there's hope for the world yet. This has been a big week in Anglo-American relations, perhaps one of the most significant in Anglo-American history. And speaking personally, I feel as if a great load had been taken off my mind. Talking to you as I have every week for so many years, knowing so many of you as I feel I do through your letters, I haven't found it easy these past weeks to remember Mother's advice about not meddling in other people's business. But I knew, as we all did in England, that it would be wrong to try and put our spoke into the arguments when the Senate and the House of Representatives were debating whether the loan should go through or not. It was agony while it lasted. Now it's over, well, we all feel as if a breath of fresh air had blown over the Atlantic. And I'd like you to believe that our hopes for the loan weren't entirely selfish. Curiously enough, the selfish people over here were the people who mostly opposed the loan. They took the arrogant nationalist view that we could fight through without it. Perhaps we could have done. But the rest of us felt very deeply that, quite apart from the material consequences of the credit for Britain, the passing or repudiation of the loan was the symbol of hope, or otherwise, for a better, more adult world. I'm only jealous that the great decision that you've made couldn't have been England's. In the past, Englishmen have said that America is the big boy who hasn't grown up. We can't say it anymore. No country has made a more grown-up decision than you have this past week. And history underlines that the big decision usually pays big dividends. And now, this is MacDonald Hastings, not forgetting the IOU, signing off from London.
You have been listening to a talk in the series London Letter by MacDonald Hastings. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.